step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
Authorities say they'll go for the death penalty in the trial of a landlady suspected of killing seven boarding home tenants. A Sacramento judge today arraigned Dorothea Puente on one murder count. Prosecutors say additional murder charges will be added. Puente did not enter a plea and is being held tonight without bail. Police named the ex-con as a suspect after finding seven bodies buried in the yard of her Sacramento boarding house. Authorities say Puente killed her tenants for their Social Security checks.
The gruesome tale began unfolding over the weekend. Sacramento police digging up body after body in the yard of a boarding home. The landlord of the home, the prime suspect, a woman who had a police record, a woman who just 6 years ago was arrested and convicted of drugging some elderly residents of another boarding home and stealing their valuables. How could she end up running another facility?
Oh, it could happen easily because she gets out of prison. She comes to Sacramento or wherever. She gets a license to do business. She's not fingerprinted. A CII check is not done. She sets up her business.
Unlike a board and care facility, those who want to open a boarding home only need a business license. And to get a business license, there is no background check, no fingerprinting, and no regulations.
We find situations where people are likely to be abused, neglected, or exploited because there's no regulation within these facilities.
The Department of Social Services is the agency that usually refers those who need a place to stay. They are the homeless, the mentally ill, those down on their luck. And while most of the homes are good places, some are not. Linda Marinian says she knows of two such places in Fresno, boarding homes she will no longer refer clients to. She told us why.
We found women getting raped. We found elderly people being physically assaulted and needing hospitalization. We found unsanitary conditions, towels and washcloths and sheets not being changed regularly.
Anne Marinia says it's not unusual to find operators who financially abuse their clients. But even if the police are called in, these cases are difficult to prosecute.
In November of 1988, a social worker showed up on Dorothea Puente's doorstep in Sacramento, California, just 1 mile from the Capitol and the Hall of Justice. The social worker, Judy Moyes, was looking for one of Puente's tenants, 51-year-old Bert Montoya. Bert had stopped showing up to his social work meetings, and this was his last known address. After speaking with Dorothea, Judy Moyes was on high alert. Something was not right. Dorothea was being evasive. Her answers didn't make any sense. So Judy would end up contacting the police, who arrived soon after this with a warrant and shovels. This would lead to days of digging in Dorothea's back garden, and nearly a 30-year secret finally coming to light. Beneath the flowers and apricot trees in the Sacramento garden and behind the lace curtains in Dorothea Puente's windows, something sinister was happening. This is part two of the story of the death house landlady and female serial killer, Dorothea Puente. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. As always, I am your host, Kadra. If you're new to the show, hello and welcome. I tell tales every single week that have perplexed me. So if you love a good mystery that leaves you wanting more, don't worry, you're in the right place. And as we wrap up this true crime deep dive today, let me know if you enjoyed. I'd love if you continue to follow along. If you are a returning listener, hello, my friends, welcome back. It is time to finish this insane, sad, enraging story of the many victims of Dorothea Puente. If you guys didn't listen to part one, be sure to go listen to that first. Today, we're going to get into how Dorothea got caught. We'll talk about the trial and the weird aftermath, the house, all this media coverage, how this case has been sensationalized in a pretty gross way, in my opinion. We left off with Bert Montoya, Puente's latest victim. I do want to issue a trigger warning for this episode. As always with true crime cases, this is going to be disturbing. We're talking about murder, very heinous crimes, so listener discretion is advised. And as always, all the sources used for today's episode will be available down in the show notes. So without further ado, let's get into part two of Dorothea Puente. So Bert Montoya was intellectually disabled and had schizophrenia. Bert was known to be very gentle, and he spent a lot of time on the streets and various homeless shelters. 13 years before he met Dorothea, he had actually been living with his parents in New Orleans, Louisiana. He wandered off one day, and his parents searched, but they were never able to track him down. They had no idea what had happened to him. Bert spent some time living on the streets and all over the U.S. until he ended up in Sacramento. He met Dorothea Puente. Bert lovingly called Dorothea Mama and quickly became very trusting of her. But after living with her for a short while, Bert grew scared. Shortly before he disappeared, he told one of his social workers, a different one, not the one who knocked on Dorothea's door, Judy Moyes, someone else that they don't name, but he tells this social worker he was worried and scared because Dorothea had been force-feeding him pills that made him sleepy. So it's at this point that the social worker calls Dorothea, not the police, calls Dorothea concerned. This obviously enraged Dorothea, and she went into her usual lies. She denied this entirely, said that Bert was a liar, and without doing anything else. This social worker fell for Dorothea's charm and deception, and the social worker actually sent Bert back to live with Dorothea and told him to apologize to her. And that was the last time that Bert Montoya would be seen alive. So once again, the systems that we have in place are failing these people. Law enforcement failed these people. The social workers failed these people. The judicial system failed these people. Failed Dorothea. She should have been in jail a long time ago, okay? But no one was really looking for Bert Montoya at this time that he disappeared. No one was looking for other people like him. According to an article from Sacktown Magazine, given Montoya's history as a transient, his disappearance would have escaped notice without the persistence of Judy Moyes. An outreach counselor with Volunteers of America, she had visited Puente before placing him in her care. In October 1988, discovering he no longer lived at the house, Moyes began to hound Puente about his departure. Her evasive answers, first claiming he had traveled to Mexico, then that he had returned and moved to Utah, tripped Moyes' suspicion. She filed a missing person report with police on November 7th. End quote. So in November, Dorothea Puente asked Donald Anthony, a former convict who had worked for her, to contact Judy Moyes, pretending to be Bert Montoya's brother-in-law. He went under a false name and called Judy, claiming that everything was fine and he had taken Bert to Utah. But Judy Moyes was not buying this. She was still suspicious and she told Dorothea that she was going to call the police. 3 days later, November 10th, the social worker received a letter, allegedly from Bert Montoya's brother-in-law. The letter was really weird, and it was wrapped in paper towel to avoid fingerprints. Not suspicious at all. During this time, Puente would also take in and harm another tenant, who we do not know much about, but this was 55-year-old Benjamin Fink. And I think I briefly mentioned him in part one, but he disappeared while all of this investigation with Bert was going on. Dorothea had grown sloppy and desperate. She was taking in more and more victims and cashing more and more checks that were really close together. And it just so happened that Bert Montoya would be the victim that would bring her house of cards tumbling down. So regarding the disappearance of Bert Montoya, police arrived on November 11th, 1988 to interview Dorothea. They also spoke with John Sharp, one of Dorothea's tenants. Sharp told police initially in front of Dorothea that everything Dorothea was saying was true. Montoya had gone to Utah. He left on his own volition. But just before the cop left, John Sharp, in secret, slipped a piece of paper to the police. He made sure that Dorothea wasn't around, and the cop uncrumbled the paper and took a look. The note would say, "She's making me lie for her." So police knew, finally, that they were onto something big. Sharp would also later go down to the police station and agree to give them more information. In this interview, John Sharp would tell police that sometime earlier, another tenant had vanished after Dorothea, quote, went to his room to make him feel better. It is believed that this was 55-year-old Benjamin Fink. After this tenant vanished, John Sharp kept noticing a putrid odor in the house. Dorothea was like, "Oh, it's nothing. Don't worry about it. It's just the sewer. It's backed up. I'm going to get it fixed. Blah, blah, blah." But this smell was so bad that it started to spread outdoors, and even the neighbors were complaining. John Sharp also told police that Dorothea had been hiring prisoners on work furlough to dig and fill large holes in the back garden, and that some of the holes had been covered with concrete. So now police have enough to get a search warrant and dig in the backyard. They showed up with two shovels after they got a tip from a local that mounds of loose dirt were in Dorothea's garden that kind of looked like a burial mound. Dorothea opened her front door with her grandmotherly demeanor, feathered white hair, tight smile, and large-rimmed glasses. She kindly and incredibly calmly greeted police, saying she had been expecting them. "Come on in." She then admitted she was in violation of her parole as for running the boarding house. She had not been permitted to do this due to being on probation for that fraud charge back from 1985. Police would take a look around the two-story Victorian home, but nothing was amiss. There were no signs of any kind of foul play. The house was immaculate, and police also couldn't help but notice the impressive photos that lined Dorothea's walls. There were photos of her dancing with California governors at fundraisers. Then police would go to the back garden. This was an entirely different story from what was found, or the lack of what was found, in the house. They saw Dorothea's carefully manicured vegetable and flower gardens, but there were also large amounts of loose dirt. After Dorothea gave the police permission, the three men began to dig around in the garden. Like I said, there were three men, and they had only brought two shovels. So they borrowed one from Dorothea. And after borrowing Dorothea Puente's shovel, police would hit what they first thought was a tree root. But after loosening the dirt some more, they would discover this was not a tree root, but very clearly a human leg bone. Dorothea looked at them, seemingly stunned, with her hand over her mouth, like, "Oh my God, I had no idea that was there." Girl, are we serious right now? It was at this point that police had to halt the dig because they needed to bring in a forensic search team, and this wouldn't be able to happen until the next day. Meanwhile, police brought Dorothea downtown for questioning, but she continued to deny having any idea how that leg bone got there. "That's just so weird. I didn't do it." She also maintained that other people lived in the home while she had been in prison, so someone else must have put that leg there. And legally, logistically, she did have a point. There were no signs of foul play in the home, and police could not directly prove at this point that the leg was tied to Dorothea. So police knew they needed more. The next day, when police would return to the house, seas of reporters and onlookers had filled the neighborhood. The news had already spread, and Dorothea was getting nervous. At one point, as police continued to dig, Dorothea asked police if she could go get a cup of coffee. So in the middle of a disappearance, and now seemingly a homicide investigation, what do police do? Do they tell her, "No, Dorothea, we're looking for bodies in your backyard, so you can't leave"? No, of course not. Police walked her personally to the hotel. And this would lead to public outrage, understandably, for the police department, and an infamous photo of Dorothea arm in arm with a police officer in this bright red long pea coat carrying a pink umbrella leaving the house. And this was obviously a ruse. Dorothea did go into the hotel, but she then used a payphone to call a taxi and she fled the area. During this time, police were unearthing more remains, and they knew when they found more human remains, oh shit, I guess we should go check on Dorothea and bring her back. Obviously, it was too late, so then police had to contact the FBI, and Dorothea Puente became a wanted fugitive for 5 days. They couldn't find this woman for 5 days. Meanwhile, a local came by during the search and told police Dorothea had paid him cash to dig holes all over her backyard, telling him she just needed help so she could, quote, bury some trash. That's what she referred to these people as. Trash. So this man was able to point out where he had dug, and ultimately, police would unearth 6 more bodies. So 7 in total. The third body found was Bert Montoya, the missing tenant that social worker Judy Moyes had come searching for. He was found under a concrete basin in the yard. His mother, who was 92 years old, was notified. She had been searching for Bert for the last 13 years. And while this was worst case scenario, Bert's mom was very thankful to know what had happened. The final body was found on November 14th, 1988, This body was just a few feet from the sidewalk. This victim was missing her head, her hands, and feet. And the whereabouts of those body parts remain unknown to this day. This body was later identified, though, as Betty Mae Palmer. Next to her body was the statue of the patron saint of missing things, Saint Anthony. The patron saint of missing things, further demonstrating how evil Dorothea truly was. The victims were all in an advanced state of decomposition, wrapped up tightly in bedsheets and duct tape, making it even harder for them to be identified. These bedsheets also came from inside the home. Thursday, November 17th, investigators tracked down fugitive and serial killer Dorothea Puente after a man sighted her at a bar in Los Angeles, nearly 400 miles away.
Authorities arrested Puente last night in Los Angeles after receiving a tip. An L.A. widower met her at a bar and says Puente seemed friendly, yet he knew something wasn't right.
Everybody in the place.
The picture kept coming back from the morning news.
She asked me about my income, and I told her, I said, well, I live on a very limited income. I live on Social Security disability. She seemed to know the figures.
She was interested in maybe getting together and sharing an apartment.
Mm-hmm. Didn't you think that was weird?
Yeah.
Well, just later remembered he had seen Puente on the news. He phoned a TV station, which immediately phoned the police to make the arrest.
When Dorothea was arrested, she declined to make a statement. She was wearing her bright red coat, and she was booked into the county jail. The victims would later be identified as 4 females, 3 males, ages 52 to 79, and several of these victims had actually been referred to Dorothea by their social workers. They were homeless or estranged from their families, struggling with addiction, so people often were not looking for them. And when they were, Dorothea would just claim that they had run away or they were just visiting family. Most of these victims also did not have their teeth. Dorothea had pulled their teeth out, making it even harder for them to be identified. But ultimately, all of these victims were identified and given a proper burial. Police later came to believe Dorothea Puente had been lacing her tenants' food and drinks, giving them a lethal mix of drugs or poisoning them, and then scheming and collecting their social security checks. By doing this, she brought in about $5,000 a month, or about $20,000 in today's money. Toxicology reports would reveal that the seven tenants who were found in the back garden had a variety of drugs in their systems. Anticonvulsants, antidepressants, antipsychotics, painkillers, and tranquilizers. But the one drug that was always present in all of these victims was Dalmane, a sedative that none of these victims had been prescribed. But you know who did have this prescription? Dorothea Puente. In fact, she had obtained this prescription more than 36 times. She was given 30 pills at a time in each of these prescriptions between October 1985 and November 1988, according to court records, she was prescribed Dalmane. In theory, this blend of narcotics detected in the victims could have proven lethal, or at least weakened them to the point of defenselessness. Think about those victims we talked about in part one that were like catatonic and paralyzed. It's then believed after this that Dorothea likely suffocated these victims with a pillow or blanket, which is a nearly untraceable cause of death. But this is not always what was done. It was determined that at least two of these victims had been buried alive. And it's believed that this was because these victims refused to hand over their financials to Dorothea. So if they didn't listen, didn't follow her orders, they were killed in an incredibly cold manner. Dalmane, when combined with alcohol, can put you in this catatonic state and ultimately stop the heart as well. So then we get to the trial. February 9th, 1993, so it took quite some time, Dorothea was put on trial for 9 murders. They found 7 victims in the back garden, but they added Ruth Monroe and Everson Gilmouth, who we haven't even talked about yet. Remember Ruth Monroe, who we talked about in part one, her death had initially been ruled a suicide, even though the drugs that killed her were found in another room and she was bedridden. This other victim, Everson Gilmouth, was 77 years old. He was from Oregon and he went by Gil. Gil was a wood and leather worker and had become pen pals with Dorothea while she was serving her 3-year prison sentence for fraud back in 85. And he was lonely. He just wanted to get married. So he fell for Dorothea's charm. And when she got released in 85, he picked her up from prison in his red 1980s Ford pickup truck. He also quickly opened a joint bank account with her, and then he started staying at the boarding house that same year. Within months, Gil's family stopped hearing from him. In October 1985, Dorothea also sent a letter to Gil's sister saying that they were in love and they were going to be getting married soon. Dorothea said the wedding was going to be on November 2nd. Then her sister got another letter, and this one was especially strange. It didn't seem like it was from her brother, even though that's what the letter was claiming. So Gil, allegedly in this letter, wrote that the wedding was off. It didn't work out. The next letter that Gil's sister got was from this woman called Irene. This was a new woman that Gil had just met and fallen in love with. Irene was writing to let the sister know that they were in love and that Gil had just had a stroke, but she was taking care of him and everything was fine. That same month, Dorothea Puente hired a handyman, Ismael Flores, to install wood paneling in her home. After he completed the job, Dorothea Puente paid him an additional $800 and gave him a red 1980s Ford pickup truck, Gil's car. She told Flores that the truck belonged to her boyfriend who had given it to her. Dorothea Puente also hired Flores to build a box for her. The box was 6 feet by 3 feet by 2 feet, and she said that she wanted to use this box to store books and other items. But this was a coffin. She and Flores then traveled in this red pickup truck, and Flores agreed to help her unload the box into a storage shed. But then along the way, the plans changed, and she was like, oh, actually, can you just pull off on the highway in Sutter County? Can we just drop this box in the river over here? And Flores is like, what? I just built this box for you, and like, it has all this stuff in it. And she's like, no, I just filled it with junk that I don't want. So on January 1st, 1986, after this box had been dumped in a river, the box was found by a local fisherman who called the police. When police arrived and opened the box, they found the decomposed remains of an unidentified elderly male. During this time, Dorothea Puente continued to collect Gil's pension and forge letters to his family. His body was later identified when Dorothea was on the run for those 5 days as a fugitive in L.A. In the trial, Dorothea admitted to burying 7 of her tenants and collecting their Social Security checks, but denied murdering them or murdering Ruth Monroe or Everson Gilmouth. And we see this constantly with serial killers and like serial rapists. They'll do a partial admission of guilt and then they'll like deny certain things to try to make themselves look better. So she was like, yeah, like I buried them and I took their money, but they just died because they killed themselves or they died of natural causes. Like I didn't do that. And I needed the money to help people. Such a sick, sadistic woman. Ruth Monroe's son, Bill Clausen, also testified during Dorothea's trial and later recalled how cold Dorothea's stare was. She was like looking at him with these dead eyes, and all that Bill could think about throughout the trial was how badly he wanted to strangle her. A psychiatrist also diagnosed Dorothea during this time as suffering from antisocial personality disorder. And if you remember in part one, a psychiatrist diagnosed her as schizophrenic and said she was an incredibly dangerous individual. I believe there was also an earlier point where she was also diagnosed with schizophrenia. So she's been, I believe, diagnosed twice by experts as schizophrenic and then this other expert as being antisocial with this personality disorder. So this expert speculated that running a boarding house began for Dorothea as a humane endeavor rooted in a deep desire to undo painful childhood trauma. Then, on the other hand, when these tenants wouldn't do what she wanted, she would kill them in incredibly sick and twisted ways. On August 26th, 1993, after 24 days of deliberation, that's the longest deliberation, by the way, in a murder case in the state's history, the jury would find Dorothea Puente guilty of 3 murders. Not 9, just 3. They were gridlocked on the others, including Ruth Monroe. There was a mistrial. And obviously, this deeply upset Ruth Monroe's family, but they also grew to accept it because they knew she would be behind bars for the rest of her life. They didn't do any other trials, ultimately because of cost. Prosecutor John O'Mara would say, quote, "Here's this grandmotherly figure in this beautiful, restored Victorian home with all these azaleas and other flowers. And then there's the contradiction. Beneath this house, there are all these bodies. It doesn't fit," end quote. That just goes to show that these people walk among us. It's harmful to condition yourself to think that these are obvious monsters, that they're inhuman. It's naive. I understand why we do it, but it's just not the case. During Dorothea's time in prison, she remained in the limelight as well. And it's at this point in the episode that I want to kind of shift and start talking about the unethical and disturbing sensationalism surrounding Dorothea.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
So she released a cookbook in 2004 called Cooking with a Serial Killer. This book can be found on Amazon. I want to read you the description of the book first, and then we're going to talk about some reviews that people have left for this book. So the description reads, quote, "Grandmotherly Dorothea Puente is becoming as renowned for her cooking as for being a notorious mass murderer, serial killer, and all-around psycho. Dorothea Puente has been accused of a lot of things. Being a bad cook isn't one of them. You see, Dorothea ran a boarding house in Sacramento, California, and the care she provided was above and beyond other care providers. But one thing everyone involved in this case keyed in on was how awesome all of her tenants thought the cooking was. One tenant went as far as saying, every dinner at Dorothea's was like Thanksgiving dinner. None of them were murdered. They died of natural causes. I couldn't do that anyhow. I'm not that type of person. I'm too caring and I worry too much about my people eating. Everybody can tell you that. Why would I spend money fattening them up if I was going to kill them? Signed, Dorothea Puente. I will never understand why we give people like this platforms. Why should they be allowed to publish books, make money, do films? Like, no, bitch, no. This book also has hundreds of five-star reviews. People left reviews like, the book didn't cost me an arm or leg. Okay? Great conversation starter. Love her or hate her. Now we can make someone's last meal, LOL. I also found a lot of people who were like, huh, found out about this cookbook from Bailey Sarian's video and I just had to buy it because I just love true crime. Can we like wake up? I know I get on a soapbox a lot about true crime ethics, but like this is so disgusting. Are we serious? In 2008, Dorothea also met with Sacktown magazine journalist, and she continued to say, and she would say this forever, that she was innocent. She said this for the rest of her life. She died on March 27, 2011, at the age of 82, while staying in a women's prison in Chowchilla, taking her secrets with her to the grave. There is reason to believe, and I totally think that this is what happened, that Dorothea had an accomplice. We know that she hired a lot of people to like bury holes for her and stuff, but it would have been very difficult for her to have dismembered people, killed them, moved the bodies, done all of that on her own. And that's a mystery in this case. We don't know who this accomplice or accomplices could have been. We don't know how much the tenants knew. But we do know that the sensationalism around Dorothea Puente has continued. In 2020, the play Dorothea Puente Tells All hit California stages. Why we need a play about this woman, I could not tell you. This play was written by Mark Lowenstern, and I will say it does seem like he found some ways to honor the victims, but I still am just like, dude, we don't need a play about this. Like, why? It doesn't seem like the victims were involved in this production either, like the victims' families. In a 2025 article from Capradio by Patty Roberts, the play is described as follows, quote, "It's one of Sacramento's most famous true crime stories, which intrigued playwright Mark Lowenstern about the many scams and manipulations Dorothea pulled, not just on her victims, but on many other people, including government officials. I was interested in how she got so many people to love and admire her while she was doing so much damage," said Lowenstern in a previous interview. "And the terrible hunger she had for people to believe the exalted image of herself that she had created." Lowenstern went with the fascinating choice to have the character of Dorothea come out, face the audience with her deflecting charm, and declare that it is her story to tell. The play goes back and forth from Dorothea justifying her side to the cast of eight actors portraying other real people involved, including victims, social workers, a parole officer, a policeman, a neighbor, and a reporter. Director Jackie Martin uses costumes which include Dorothea's famous red coat. Videos that honor the victims and real local news stories of the unfolding crime. I understand that the media can be very effective in getting important messages across, but I'm sorry, in my opinion, I just feel that this play is like completely unnecessary. I don't understand why this was needed for people to see. If this was like a museum exhibit dedicated to the victims and had like a lot of pictures of them and like messages from family and their stories, I feel like that would be interesting to see, but it just seems too sensationalized and too focused on Dorothea when that's not what this should really be about. In addition to the play, the cookbook, all of these interviews, there is also Dorothea Puente's Victorian house in Sacramento. So Dorothea's house is now considered a historic site. It has the same original flooring. They're very proud of that. And the home has become a very popular tourist attraction. Ghost Adventures, Zach Bagans, not fond of that guy, also did an episode about the house and said it was allegedly haunted. The owners of the house have also more than leaned into the dark history of the house, saying in the docuseries, World's Most Evil Killers, quote, "We love it. We have no problem whatsoever with any of it. So this is just our house. We made it a home and we're pretty happy with it," end quote.
Where her first body was buried underneath this fountain here. It was distinctive because it had no head, hands, or feet.
This is the room Puente stored her victims' bodies before burying them. It is now the master bedroom.
Right now it's our room, but originally she used this area to lay out the bodies.
The Williamses say they couldn't pass up the five-bedroom duplex's price tag of $215,000, a bargain basement discount due to the house's notorious history.
The price was killer.
They really try to embrace the home's criminal past.
We do like to have some fun here. This is the shower curtain that we chose for our bathroom.
They have memorabilia around the home and even a life-size statue of the serial killer by the front door.
This is Dorothea Puente. It's to make light of everything so that people look at it and they see funny, they don't see dead bodies.
On their mailbox, they also proudly display a sign with a picture of the house that says, "It was that awful, awful woman that did it. Don't blame us," signed the house. And this really made me angry. They have a sign that hangs on the outside of the house that reads, "Trespassers will be drugged and buried in the yard." Ha ha, don't you get it? It's really funny, guys. T-shirts have also been sold with drawings of Dorothea with a shovel in her hand and the phrase, "I dig it." This is the issue that I have with true crime. Dorothea Puente's story has also been mentioned in the Netflix series Worst Roommate Ever, and it was used as the backdrop of Dorothea, a campy, low-budget horror film that premiered in North Hollywood on Halloween. So between the house, the cookbooks, the low-budget horror movies, I think it's pretty clear that we have an ethical dilemma on our hands. I have spent many episodes talking about this perplexing phenomenon. Why are we so fascinated with serial killers? And yes, I also recognize that this could come across as hypocritical. I just spent two episodes talking about this woman, but I think there is a big difference between telling the story and sensationalizing. The truth is, in death and in life, these victims deserved so much better. Their stories deserve to be told in a delicate and meaningful way. They're not a punchline, a cookbook, a tourist attraction. These were parents, siblings, grandparents, kind people in the community who were willing to get help. They had an entire life before this sadistic cold woman murdered them or took advantage of them, drugged them. And yet, source after source after source that I came across during my research was all about seemingly idolizing Dorothea Puente. In part one, we named all the victims and talked at length about them. It was actually pretty hard to track down information about the victims in most of the sources that I came across. By and large, most of these sources did not even include the victims' names. So perhaps this is a full circle moment. Dorothea Puente remained undetected for years because she had a keen ability to blend seamlessly into society. She was a grandmotherly, charming figure. And when we think about serial killers, we often think that they'll stick out like a sore thumb, that they're inhuman, they're monsters. But what is scarier, and the truth, is these people walk amongst us and live in our communities. Unlike outwardly violent psychopaths as well, like Ted Bundy or Richard Ramirez, there are high-functioning psychopaths out there that use charm, deception, and intelligence to manipulate people. And this was Dorothea Puente. She was a Black Widow type of killer. She used social engineering, a psychological manipulation technique that exploits people's trusts to maintain her secret life. Her motive was purely survival and financial. She saw these victims as subhuman. But these victims were anything but. And those are the people that we need to remember. So I guess what I'm saying is, it's pretty ironic that this woman spent 30 years going undetected, getting away with her crimes because she was so charming, seemingly. And now, in a way, the media is doing the same thing. They're putting this woman on a macabre and dark, but a pedestal. Do you get what I'm saying? I don't know. It's upsetting in stories like this that there are people that come out of the woodwork and try to sensationalize the house as well. There's like a mannequin of Dorothea on the front door, arm in arm with a mannequin police officer in her like red coat. It's just gross to me. So I have spent the last several weeks on this case, and I'm going to take a much needed break now. But that is the story of the death house landlady, female serial killer, Dorothea Puente. And thank you to that TikTok user, Ridgeback Mom, for bringing awareness to me about this case. I think they initially were specifically talking about how the house was haunted. I didn't watch the Ghost Adventures episode. Don't get me wrong, sometimes I watch things like that, but in this case, it just didn't feel right. I think that this is an example of sensationalism, and I think that these victims deserved much better. I think that the police should have put Dorothea away so many times before we got to 1988. But that is the perplexing story of Dorothea Puente. Thank you guys very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this story. If you enjoyed the way this was told, let me know. If you're watching on YouTube, drop a comment down below. Like this video, subscribe. It helps the show. Share this story with someone for awareness. And if you are listening on a podcast platform, you can hit that follow button, leave a 5-star review. That's by and large how I get new listeners. It boosts me up the algorithms. I know it's annoying me talking about this, hitting the buttons, blah, blah, blah. I hate it. But I am a cog in the machine at the end of the day with stuff like this. So it's very helpful. Thanks in advance for that. And if you want to support the show further, there's tons of support links down below. You can get early ad-free episodes and nearly 100 pieces of bonus content over on the Perplexed Society. So that is my Patreon. That's patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast. My merch links, my Buy Me a Coffee link, all those things are down below. So that's much appreciated. And if not, also totally understand. I just appreciate you being here and listening. You all are amazing. I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe. And I will talk to you next week. Bye.
Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast, is hosted, written, and produced by me, Kadra Brannon. This show is proud to be a part of the Black Cat Network. Assistant editor is Charlie Leopold. Theme song by Patrick Thompson. All music used in this episode is from Pixabay. If you like the show, be sure to share it with others and leave a 5-star rating and review. Contact, support, and merch links can be found in the episode description. To unlock early ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus content, join the Perplexed Society at patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast. Listener stories, topic requests, and business inquiries can be submitted to perplexitymysterypodcast.com or emailed to perplexitymysterypodcast@gmail.com. Until next week, stay curious.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.